The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, I'm teaching a retreat right now at IRC, just started. And it's a little bit special for me because this is an experienced students retreat. And some of these people have had a lot of years of practice. So I'm able to teach a little differently than I usually do. And I thought I'd share one thing with you from that retreat. Now, it's meant a little bit for advanced practitioners, so don't get discouraged or distraught, what I'm about to say. But, you know, if you don't care for it, then just, you know, take it or leave it. So, part of the purpose of the practice of mindfulness in the Buddhist context is to come to know something for yourself. To know it that well that, in the language of the Buddha, you become independent in the Dharma. You can stand on your own 2 feet. You don't have to read any book. You don't have to listen to any Dharma teacher. You know your way in the practice. You know what the practice is about. And you can kind of find your way and doing it deep in the practice. And there's a test kind of a Buddhist test for people who think that, you know, that. And the test is almost like this, that I've said it here before, so maybe some of you heard it. And that is that the Buddha shows up. He comes in and he looks around and he said, "You guys, you know, let me tell you something. I made a mistake. It was all wrong. I had it all wrong. You should forget about it." That's a test. And it's what would you do in response? And there's, you know, an expected answer. And the answer is that you've made it so personal, the practice, that you yourself have seen something, known something, that for yourself, it doesn't matter whether the Buddha agrees with it or not. It doesn't matter because you know for yourself. It can't be taken away. You know the benefits of it. You know it's all, how good it is. So that kind of certainty is kind of one of the goals of the practice. When a person has that kind of certainty, then there's an opportunity for the practice to do the person, rather than you do the practice. You understand that difference? So one is that, you know, you have to practice. You have to kind of do your work, and it's, you know, keep showing up, being mindful, let go of your thoughts, come show up. But at some point, the practice is flowing in you. You're so connected to something internally, maybe, mostly what you have to do is kind of relax. And you have to be present, but being present is not so hard. In the beginning, it's very hard to show up and stay present. But at some point, it's easier and easier. And then it's mostly a matter, since you can stay present, you don't have to work at that so much, then it's a matter of just allowing, opening up, and allow something to happen. And one analogy of this is that there's a seed inside of you, and when you really know what the practice is about, that seed has sprouted. And now what you have to do is kind of just nourish it, get out of the way, keep the weeds away, and allow it kind of to grow in you. It's not a matter of you doing it, but you allowing it. Another analogy that's used is that once you know it so well for yourself, then you're in the current, and the current of the Dharma, and then you want to relax and flow on the current. You want to let the current take you. Whereas initially it's like, you know, for some people it's so hard, you do the practice, feels like you're climbing up a mountain or something. But now it's, you know, it's kind of easy. It's just a matter of just opening up, relaxing, going with it. It takes strong mindfulness, but this is advantage when you're really there and you're connected to something you know yourself. But then it's a little peculiar, this whole enterprise, because There's no thing. We say we really know the Dharma for ourselves. In a sense, really at the heart of the matter, there is no thing that you're supposed to know. And there's no experience you're supposed to have. And there's no teaching that can tell you what it is, kind of, you know. Or there's nothing to attain, to get, to acquire. So then, like, you should go home now, right? And there's nothing for you. And this is because there's some kind of essence or heart of what the practice is. It has to do with an absence. So it's kind of like it's such a radically meaningful absence rather than something. Many of us are oriented towards having things and making success and progress and getting more and more stuff and having status or something. Or protecting ourselves or defending against ourselves or, I don't know, all kinds of things that are sometimes necessary to do. But when we do the spiritual life, in that time of our life, then what we realize through this mindfulness practice, something very significant about an absence. An absence is not something you can acquire. You can't, you know, like, I got it. My absence is better than yours. what can you say about an absence? Or what can you... You know, an absence is not quite an experience. It's not an experience of the senses. Someone might say it's an experience, a radical absence, but it's not experience of the senses. It's not like you hear something or taste something or see something. So here are some analogies for this idea of kind of how important absence is. It's actually quite important in our lives. Ordinarily, we don't pay much attention to it. So in Japan, in temples and some homes, they have something, I think it's called tokomono. And it's an alcove, a recess in the wall. And they're different sizes, but, you know, and there's a kind of a low shelf, pretty low, and there's this alcove. And usually there's nothing in there, kind of except something, one thing that's kind of special. And it's not unusual for that to be a flower, a single flower. And rather than a whole bouquet or something, it's kind of crowded. And the whole bouquet, you see the arrangement, the whole thing, but you don't really look at each flower. And that one flower stands there, and what makes the flower, you know, so highlighted is the absence. There's nothing else in the alcove. That absence highlights the specialness and uniqueness of the flower that couldn't be highlighted if it was just crowded up with lots of other flowers in a big bouquet. Or if you kept all your books piled up inside the alcove and the flower was tucked away in the back or something. But because of the kind of pristine simplicity of that little wall space, the flower stands up by itself. So mindfulness is a little bit like that. That we're trying to, it's kind of like, I think sometimes awareness is like the sacred altar or the sacred alcove, a special recess or something. That we have an absence of a lot of thinking, a lot of judging, a lot of commentary, a lot of bias, a lot of all kinds of things, expectations, agendas around what we're present for. And we allow each thing that we're aware of to kind of just be there in its simplicity, pristine simplicity. And it becomes exquisite to see all kinds of things in a way that was like looking at that flower. That isn't when our minds are crowded with thoughts and ideas and fears and emotions and all that, right? And so mindfulness is kind of like in the absence of a lot of busyness of the mind, we experience our life, our mindfulness, our things in a certain kind of pristinely beautiful way. So that's one area of the absence is important. The other is in the Buddhists have this very important metaphor that's used for Buddhist practice, so much so that this word, this metaphor, is almost equated with Buddhism, and that is the metaphor of a path. Buddhism is a path religion. It's all about having a path, a road, you know, to go on. And the analogy is that it's a path that goes through the woods. What makes a path passable is there's an absence of the trees and shrubs. Without that absence, you can't, the path doesn't work. You know, it's obstructed by bushes and undergrowth and all that and trees. So there's a clearing that allows you to go through. And you're clearing the way where you find the path, like so the Buddhist path. So here's what's kind of fun about this analogy. The word in the ancient language for woods, forest, and craving is the same word, vana. So it's a kind of a wordplay. So the path through the woods is where there's a clearing that you can walk through. So an absence of trees, so you can walk through. The Buddhist path is also a clearing and absence, and it's the absence of craving. And then you, if you really understand in a visceral, palpable, kind of experiential way, in your body and in the kind of processes of your mind, you understand or can see or feel the heart, the mind, not craving, not clinging to anything, then there's an absence there, absence of clinging. And that is where you find the path, where it deepens. And they say that when you really find that, really know it, then it no longer becomes a path. It becomes a current in the river. And you can ride on that current. It can take you deeper and deeper. And then the third absence that is significant is that, a door, when it's closed, it's closed, and you can't go through. But if the door is open, the door frame now is absent the door. And that absence allows you to go through the door. What's useful about doors to get through is to have the door absent, you know, swung open. So in Buddhism, there's something called the doors of liberation. And the doors of liberation, when those doors open, then a person experiences liberation. And the doors of liberation are what opens when there's a thoroughgoing lack, absence of clinging, of craving, of hate, of greed. All those things drop away. And that gives a person opportunity to go through into this whole different kind of way of being. So absence is actually quite important. So to know the Dharma, to know Buddhism, or become independent of the Dharma, is kind of not an ordinary attainment. Don't go around being conceited about it, because it's nothing. It's an absence, but it's an absence that's really liberating, really important for people. And so finally what I'll say in this short talk is that there are more important absences in your life all the time than there are things. But we don't normally pay attention to the things. So to get anywhere, there has to be absent something. There's nothing blocking the way. You walk in through from here to the bathroom out there in the outer hall. It's not full of people, so it's absence of people. There's space, and so you can walk through it. But you might be so busy thinking about, what do all the people out there think about my socks? I wear the right socks to IMC, and what do these Buddhists think about socks? And you have important things to think about. And so you're thinking about something, socks, and you're missing the fact there's all this absence going on. And it's a little bit silly to talk about that analogy, but it's also true in the mind. Our minds are often preoccupied by things. We're caught up in things. So maybe you have something you're really caught up in today, really preoccupied with today. I'm pretty sure that compared to all the things you could be preoccupied about, you're actually not preoccupied with very much. You're mostly absent of a lot of preoccupation. You're mostly absent a lot of clinging. It's kind of a silly thing to say, right? But if you could somehow feel or recognize, I'm not clinging to a lot of things. And one way to do it that makes it a little bit more, you know, personal, maybe you clung to something a week ago, or you had some big preoccupation a year ago that you don't have now. So you know what it was like to be preoccupied, and now you're not with that. So maybe you're on to new preoccupations. You don't, you know, you're not paying any attention to what that was like to be absent of the former one. But stop and notice what that's like, not to have that anymore. And you'll find there's actually a lot more non-preoccupation going on than preoccupation. There's absence of this. And there might be a little bit of a clue or a hint or feeling, a quality of that possibility, of that quality of mind that happens when the mind is not contracted around something or caught. Does that make sense? So mindfulness makes space, makes absent space around things so you can really see what's there in a clearer way and pristine way. As we start seeing and we don't cling and react to everything all the time, it makes an absent space. We find the path of practice, how to go forward and expand it. As that expansion of non-clinging gets greater and greater, it becomes, the Buddhists talk about it becoming a door you go through into a whole different way of being. So, last thing I'll say, if you want to try to have a little bit of fun with this idea, notice tomorrow as you go through your day how many times you're going through a space because it's absent of things. There's a very meaningful absence. Stop being so preoccupied with all the things that are so important, just for one day. And just notice the absence that's allowing you to move through, or allowing you to hear the music, or allowing you to have the view. You know, you go to the park and you can look across the lawn and see the trees. It's so nice. It's the absence of obscuration allows you to see across the vista. Notice what's absent and how that supports you. And if you can do a little exercise in the world, maybe it gives you a little feeling for how you can do it in your own mind. And once you start appreciating the absence of the air, maybe your mind will start feeling freer and more spacious and more open and easier to be with. And you'll know something about the Dharma. That nothing to attain, just things to empty out of. Okay, so that was I did my job tonight. Now it's your turn. So what would you like to talk about? Some of you nodded your head about discussion, so. Yes.
Hello.
Yeah.
I have a question. How does one distinguish, or how might you distinguish, between the absence of clinging and indifference?
It's a great question. I think this is where mindfulness helps a lot, because you can feel the difference. So if you pay really careful attention, indifference is a very subtle aversion. And so it's not quite absent. Something is there. So you can feel the tension of that, the stress of having that. So that's the best way. I think indifference is a little bit debilitating. It's the energy level drops. There's not so much clarity. There's a wind drag. We're kind of like dragging a little bit more. And also sometimes with indifference, the people you're with are not really seen as valued and important people. That's my idea. So this is a very important question. And anybody else have ideas about the difference between, you know, how you recognize indifference? Yeah.
I think indifference also has a quality of contempt underneath it too. Usually there's some sort of a dislike associated with it too, in my opinion.
So especially with people, a sense of contempt or dislike.
I guess also there's a certain type of kind of obliviousness that goes with aversion. Indifference. Indifference.
Oblivious, sorry. Yes. You're not really seeing what's there. And, yeah.
Yeah. About clinging. What about clinging to practice?
Oh, cling to the practice as long as it helps you.
It's okay.
And when it's, but if you really, that's why mindfulness is also important. You have to watch and see the consequences. Someday, the clinging to practice will get in the way. It'll be harmful. But until that day, cling to it.
And okay, I have to ask now, what do you do when it becomes harmful?
When you feel the conflict or the problem with it?
Yeah.
Then you let go of it. You let go of the clinging to the practice, but you keep doing the practice. Or say a different thing you can do. This is a basic principle in this practice, and that is you'll always want to see more clearly what's going on. You want to feel what's going on. So at some point, if you recognize I'm clinging to the practice, it doesn't feel good, feel it better. In a sense, suffer better. You know, feel it better so you really see it. Because then if you really see what's going on in a deeper, clearer way, then it becomes more natural to let go. It's more natural to find a way around it. But if it's an idea, oh, this is bad, I'm a bad Buddhist, Buddhists are not supposed to cling, you know, I should let go. That, I think, it does. You probably won't really let go then. Is that a satisfying answer for you, or
yes?
Enough to think about or try.
Great.
Here.
When you speak of absence, I think of emptiness. Could you say a little more how emptiness supports being?
Yeah. So, you know, the topic of Buddhists love the topic of emptiness, and there's like 108 types of emptinesses. there's a lot of teachings in some schools of Buddhism about emptiness, but the emptiness I was talking about today was absence, which is a particular kind of emptiness, which there's just simply absent of something, and one of the core absences that our tradition emphasizes. Kind of is the absence of some inherent core, permanent, lasting self, like a soul. There's not something permanent essence inside of us to organize ourselves with or be attached to. It's absent that. And that's also, if you don't have to believe that, but if you are bring a lot of mindfulness to what goes on inside, people sooner or later will feel that if they're holding on to some idea of an essential self, it'll feel very unsatisfactory to hold on to it. And it'll feel a lot better to be absent of it, to realize the emptiness of self, or this kind of soul-like self. And then it's just a lot easier to go through the world.
So to be relieved of the burden of the self.
Yeah. Of this attachment to self.
Thank you.
You still get to be yourself. Kind of.
I just wanted to point out that the address here is 108 Birch Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I think about the absence of clinging, you know how you say that how to let go of clinging, I always think of like a toothache. So you have a terrible toothache, and all of a sudden you go to the dentist and they take care of it and it doesn't hurt anymore and it's just gone. That's how I think of clinging.
Mm.
How letting go of clinging. It's like that toothache. You don't ever think about it again. It's just, you move on.
So do you just move on, or is there for a period of time a certain joy, delight?
No, relief? You just, it's not there. It's gone. Toothache's gone. It doesn't bother you anymore. You just go about your day.
So the difference between what you're describing and what we would do in Buddhist practice is that if you're able to let go of clinging, an experience of clinging falls away, We say, don't just go on with your day. Take time to let that register. Take time to really, just like everything deserves its attention in mindfulness practice. And the falling away of things also should pay, also deserve, even though it's an absence, it should also deserve careful mindfulness. What's that like? How's that felt? Where's the relaxation?
You mean the transition between, is that what you're talking about?
It could be all of it. So if there's a gradual transition into absence of clinging, track it, be with it. But once the clinging is gone, whatever you're clinging to, see if you can feel what changes there have been in your body, changes in your heart, changes in your body. Get to know what that experience is like.
For how long?
I mean,
it doesn't require a lot that much thought, does it?
And the reason is that you want to let it register really deeply so you recognize it. So it's kind of like a physical memory. Because if you have a really strong memory or experience of freedom, you're more likely to notice when you lose it, the freedom, when you get caught. But if you let go of clinging and you have all these important things to do and, you know, more websites to visit, then you go on to the next thing, you haven't really learned how nourishing, how satisfying, how beneficial the state of non-clinging is.
So it's more like drug addiction or alcoholism, where you work through a program and you go through the different changes and you recognize the difference between being addicted or being practicing addiction and not practicing addiction.
Sure. You're not the first one who said that Buddhism looks like a recovery program.
So you said absence is one type of emptiness. Could you maybe talk about a few other types of emptiness?
I think they all have to do kind of with absences. But in Zen or Mahayana Buddhism, they chant a short sutra, a short chant called the Heart Sutra. And one of the important lines is, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That which is form is empty, that which is empty is form. And so there what they're doing is so this form means an object. So like this object here, this striker, it still gets to be itself. But it's both form and empty. So where's the emptiness in here? And what they say in Mahayana, it's empty of any inherent existence. There's no inherent true striker that's inside. You could open it up and you won't find the striker. You know, it's a striker as a convention. It could be some other object, right? It could be I don't know what else. It could be something else, right?
A dowel.
It could be a dowel. It could be, you know, prop open a door a little bit. It could be door prop. It could be, it could be all kinds. You could use, if you took it home, and you probably find something else to do with it that might be interesting. So it could be anything. There's nothing about this which is inherently a striker. So the striker doesn't live in this. It lives in our functional use of it. So they would say that it's empty of inherent striker. So it's form, it's something, but at the same time, it's empty of some inherent quality, essence. But also what they say in this Heart Sutra, for them, they don't emphasize any kind of emptiness apart from form. So you're not trying to look for some kind of existential blank space. It's all about how you see what's actually here. And why they make such a big deal of it in Zen is that the idea that if you realize there's nothing inherent striker in this, then you're more likely not to cling to it. That's the hope. So that's one answer. But there are books and books. There's even a book called The Emptiness of Emptiness.
So is it an
Well, it can't be too empty, otherwise the publisher probably wouldn't have paid for it. To get it. Yes, in the back. Okay.
Thank you. You just mentioned you have to be aware of the state when you're empty, to be aware of the state when you're present, when you're absent or empty. And I feel like after every meditation session, there's like one particular awareness of like mind expanding, just like a balloon which was constricted and it just inflated a bit. But to maintain that state requires a constant effort. And it's kind of contradicting that you have to be, you know, you have to apply efforts to be in that state mm-hmm. all the time. Shouldn't it be an effortless observation to be in that state of absence? Or is it by nature?
You know? What you want to do is bring more mindfulness to see what's going on for you. So I could go around for a long time with my hand in a fist. And someone tells me there's a meditation practice that can help your hand open up. And it gets more and more expansive. It's expansive. Wow, that's great. That's great. And then I notice that I keep wanting to clench again. And I have to keep work to keep it open. Oh, it's so much work. I get exhausted from all the work. And then I say, you know, I should look more carefully at what's going on. And I notice that when it's open like that, I get afraid. And I start clenching to make myself safe. When it's open like that, I think about, how wonderfully soft the hand is. But then I think of, but I might not, people might steal my stuff. So I better go, you know, grab again. So there's all these beliefs that come into play. So instead of doing the work, you look at what is it that is causing you to contract from your balloon thing. And once you learn what that is and can let go of it, at some point you don't have to work anymore to be expansive. It's just actually it's easier to be expansive at some point than it is to contract. Does that make sense? So take a good look and see what you're doing. And if you keep fighting it, then you might not take the time to see what you're actually doing, that you're losing it.
So you mentioned experiment you suggested about sort of paying attention to the absences that allow you to walk. Do you have sort of any other one day experiment, like mindfulness experiments of things to try out?
Isn't that enough? You do it for 2 days. Yeah, since you're asking, I appreciate that. There's lots of things you can do. But here's, I think, a powerful one. Before you speak, for one day, before you speak, don't ask yourself, what's the purpose of what you're going to say? Why are you saying what you're going to say? You'll learn, so if you really stop and take a deep look, why am I going to... And don't just settle for the first, obvious thing, like, the person asked for directions, so I gave directions. If you could finish with it. I was trying to show off. I was trying to show that I'm a good direction giver. So you keep asking, why am I saying what I'm about to say? That's good. And then if you want another one, you'll have a busy week, is try for one day, when you speak, to not use the word me, I, myself, any kind of pronoun to refer to yourself. Unless someone asks you a question, and you want to be natural, then when you ask, what's your birthday? And you say, oh, my birthday is, just you. But don't you, in any conversation you initiate, don't put the self into it. And see what you'll learn. The value of this is when you learn. What's going on? What happens there? And for me, it was really great. I lived in Japan for a year. And in Japan, when you speak Japanese, it's very rare that people use pronouns. They can use them, but it's actually a lot of syllables. If you want to use like English, it's so easy. We say I. In Japanese, you have to use four syllables to say I. You know, watashi wa. You're saying something like, as for me. And so it's a little bit cumbersome. And but anyway, it's kind of also considered a little bit impolite to you know, concede it if you use I a lot. And so it was fascinating to learn to start speaking Japanese, because I kind of spoke it like I spoke English, which meant a lot of I. So I did a lot of watashi was. And so I kind of stood out. It kind of like was kind of jarring for me to keep hearing this. So I learned a lot about myself and why I kept using I, what it represented in me, and the conceits and concerns and all these things. So is that enough to keep you busy?
Yeah.
Great.
Thanks.
I'll give you a fourth one. Don't be busy. Yes. So we're going to have the mic up in the front here. It might not be on. You have to push the button in the middle. And yeah.
If you're going through a period of intense resistance or doubt, do you have some more specific instruction on how to kind of pivot towards this state of appreciating emptiness or absence?
What occurs to me is kind of a basic approach to this practice here, and that is you actually turn towards the doubt. And where the emptiness is, or where the absence is to be towards it, move towards the doubt, to really be present for it without any reactivity, if you can, without fear of it or believing it, without being for or against it. And what it would look like, the kind of emptiness, you know, not bombarding it, not getting contracted around it, it would look like your mind did this to it. It came with awareness, would just come and just hold your doubt like this. And just hold it. And so there's lots of space around it. And not trying to do anything with it. And so it's absence of doing and fixing. But just hold it gently, kindly. Like it's a little injured bird that you have to hold to take to safety or something. And just kind of care for it and love it. So that your doubt feel safe. And then see what happens. Did I see a hand over here before? No. Apparently not. Oh.
Yeah, I didn't know if I heard what you said completely, but bana is the Pali word for woods.
V-A-N-A, bana.
Vana.
It means woods or forest. So it also means craving.
So is nirvana meaning no woods or no?
Oh, nirvana. I think there are, see, in India, they love etymologies, and they make them up.
So
I think there might be some place where they say, you know, nirvana is kind of like related, but it's actually a different etymology. Nirvana, nirvana. There's a story of the Buddha saying, you know, cut down the craving, and the monks went and cut all the trees down. And then he said, that's not what I meant. Yes.
So sometimes I, like a thought comes and I notice the thought,
then I notice I'm noticing, then I notice I'm commenting on my noticing, then I'm noticing my commenting on my noticing, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I just feel like...
Start over.
Okay.
Just take a deep breath, let it go, and start over.
Okay.
And if it starts, if you do it again, then just stop it earlier. And every time, if it keeps recurring, that whole syndrome, which is common enough, just get really attentive to stop it right away.
Just move back to breath or body.
Yeah, yeah, just go back to the breath and start over.
Okay. And then sometimes I feel, you know, like me and like this and the ego is like, you know, like this body thing and the ego was like, you know, it kind of like, they feel like they kind of were born together, you know, you know, it's not that I'm trying to get rid of my ego anymore, but sometimes I feel trapped with it. You know, it's like being in a marriage you can't get out of. Right? And I don't know, and so sometimes, yeah, there's like a little kind of aversive feeling.
Uh-huh. So one of the, again, another key aspect of this mindfulness practice is the difference between what's happening and your relationship to it. And sometimes the most important part to think to notice is your relationship to the experience. So with this discomfort that you're feeling about this marriage between you and your ego, is your sound, it may be your relationship to that discomfort that's important. You have aversion to it, or you might have judgment about it, or you're something. And maybe that's where your freedom can be found. They still might be married, but the second layer of reactivity can relax. And once that second outer level of reactivity reacts, and you have a simpler relationship to it, and you're not troubled by it, then you're in a better position to investigate the ego itself. What is that about? But it doesn't make sense to investigate and really get to know it deeper, and if you're kind of the outer layer is reacting to it.
So what she was asking initially about the thoughts and then thinking about whatever it was that she was thinking, etc., why stop?
Well, it just kind of gives you a headache after a while. It just goes on. I mean, the way she described it, it just becomes an endless loop of keep doing it. It's like endless mirrors. You know, I'm thinking that I'm thinking, and it just like, it doesn't stop. So I think it's just simpler just to stop it and start over. But you could continue, and sometimes if it's a common thing that the mind keeps doing that, then you want to just keep doing it and bring careful mindfulness to it. Because there might be some underlying attitude or emotion or belief system that's kind of operating on automatic pilot. There might be some kind of fear that's operating. And so that fear is driving this concern. Or there might be an underlying feeling of perfectionism. You know, I have to do this mindfulness perfect. And if it's there, I have to be mindful of it. And so, you know, so then it just, you end up this endless kind of loop. And then if you see the fear or see the perfectionism, maybe that can let go, and then this recurring kind of loop stops. So there's a lot of things you could do when you practice. But sometimes just do the first approach is just do what seems like the easiest. So that's why I offer that. That's a nice sound to tell us it's 9 o'clock. So this was nice to sit here with you for me. I hope it was nice for you and have this discussion, and I appreciated your questions, and I hope I did okay with my little Dharma talk impromptu and absence. And I hope that, this has been useful, and gives you something to explore in your life. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you.